Dies ist der HIGH-Podcast, Folge 131. Heute mit Fergal Mullen, Co-Founder und Partner Highland Europe. Heute ist Donnerstag, der 14. Januar 2021. Unser Thema heute: Wie denkt und arbeitet Highland Europe, einer der größten Venture-Kapitalgeber des Kontinents? Wo hinein wird investiert und wie ist es jüngst gelungen, einen neuen Fonds mit Rekordgröße in Rekordzeit aufzulegen? Ein tiefer Einblick in Europas Venture-Kapital-Szene, der endlich mehr Geld zufließt. Fergal Mullen, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me today.
Fergal, you're the co-founder and partner of Highland Europe, and Highland Europe just recently made headline news all through business press in Europe and the world for raising a new fund with 700 million capacity, 700 million euros. It's the fourth fund that you have raised, and you have raised it in record time. You announced the news in December 2020, and part of the news was that you were able to raise this new fund in very, very short time. Could you explain what happened and how you managed to raise so much money for a new venture fund in Europe in such a short time?
Sure. Well, we benefit from having a tremendous track record as we enter our fourth fund. Funds one, two, and three are performing exceptionally well. All of the investors who joined us on fund one came to fund two, with a few new big investors, institutional investors joining. That entire cohort came to fund three with a few new joining. And I'm very happy to say that on fund four, all of the prior investors from fund three came again, but for even more capital. And we were able to accommodate a limited number of new investors who had spent the past two and a half, three years getting to know us.
Just to get the numbers straight, you have 1.8 billion under management now, 700 of which are from the new fund. So it would be 1.1 billion from the other three, right?
That is correct. Yeah, so we, you know, we were delighted to bring all of those investors forward. If this was a SaaS business, you could say we have negative churn. We've got tremendous lifetime value in all of these contracts. Our investors stick with us because they trust us. And I'll give you a few numbers. The 463 million of fund three became 550 million on fund four. Meaning all those investors, that cohort of investors, they didn't just come back. They came back with substantially more capital, which means then that we had about 150 million approximately to allocate to a limited number of new investors on the fund. So when we launch a fundraise, which we did in late July, we pretty much know before we even launch that most of our investors, if not all, will be coming back. And we also know from our pipeline and the meetings that have taken place in the prior years between funds who is most interested and most eligible to join our next fund. And that's why we're able to raise this so quickly. Mm-hmm. You might wonder about the July timeframe. We started in July, we finished in September. The only reason that we announced in December was that we had a limited number of investors that preferred to have a second close closer to end of year. So of course we accommodate, but therefore we cannot announce the fundraising until the fund is finally closed.
So what you're saying is you raised it in July, August, September. So in the space of, 12 weeks?
Yeah, so we started on the 26th of July and we finished on the 24th of September.
That is amazing. That is really 8 weeks.
Pretty much.
This is basically you sending out a couple of emails and reaching out with calls, right? There wouldn't have been much space during COVID for international travel. So you didn't go on a roadshow in a traditional sense, did you?
No, we didn't. We didn't have a need for a roadshow because all of the existing investors know us so well. But we had many, many hours of deep, deep diligence sessions on all topics, strategy, team, existing track record, performance of companies, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I had one or two new investors who joined for, I'll tell you one small story. I had one investor who joined for 40 million of new capital on Fund 4. And I knew the investor. I know the investor quite well for at least 25 years, but I just decided at the last minute that it was appropriate to fly to Copenhagen to meet that investor in person just to say thank you, because it just didn't feel right to me to accept 40 million of new capital without shaking somebody's hand and thanking them for their trust.
It wasn't handshaking, was more of a knuckle bump probably in COVID times, or
exactly. It was exactly that. Thank you for correcting me.
I didn't correct you. I was just guessing. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. That was the only business trip that I made, that was the only physical meeting that we had during fundraising.
Fergal, I find two issues very, very exciting and novel. Number one is that there's so much money for European fund available in the first place. This was unheard of for a long time and was unimaginable 5 to 10 years ago. There were funds, yes, but they were much smaller. So 700 million fund, it would be rather one less zero. So it would be like in the region of 70 to 100 million, but not 700 million. So what happened here? And the second issue is there's a lot of money on the market, but you as a renowned fund accepting so much money is also novel, because it puts you under pressure, because you need to, obviously you need to invest and you want to invest. And what you don't want to create is an asset inflation where unsuited startups get too much money. Prices go up, valuations go up, and nothing was much won, rather than just making a few founders richer. So the two effects that I have just described, where's all the money coming from? Where's all the confidence coming from? And what makes you confident that you can invest it in a sensible way, able to further the amount of money and to create alpha in the existing European ecosystem?
You're on a very important topic here, maybe the most important topic in any asset class or investment class. For us, I'll start by saying we could have raised $1.5 billion easily.
Really?
Really. And our strategy simply does not call for that. So we're not the kind of team or partnership or firm that will just grow AUM for the sake of growing AUM. We have a strategy that's growth stage focused. Well, our strategy very simply is Europe tech growth in three words. And we believe fundamentally that there is more competitive advantage in focus than in anything else. Therefore, our focus is, just as I described, Europe tech growth. And the growth for equation for us is companies typically in the 5 to 10 million range, recurring revenue, growing very rapidly, not less than 50%, but at that scale, often more than 100%. With sensible unit economics and a capital efficiency that makes sense, always driven by a founder-led team that we get to know very well and that we can enjoy working with, because we want to have some fun along the way. So if I describe that as our strategy and tell you that we fundamentally believe in this focus, you can see why we don't need $1.5 billion. Our team is, if you do the numbers bottoms up, we grew our capital per investor a little bit on this fund. While the overall fund size grew quite a bit, the capital per investor on my team, on the overall Highland Europe team, didn't grow that much, because we had a couple of partner promotions. So of course I need capital for the new partners. And we also have a couple of principals that's just a level below partner for us, who are now starting to make their own investments. So the correct way to think about capital on any fund is what's right for the strategy. Secondly, what's right for the market. And last but not least, what's right for the team and the capacity of the team and the capability of the team that you have in place. So if you do that bottoms up and top down, for us, 700 million was a perfect number.
And where's all the money coming from? Why is the market so liquid all of a sudden?
It's not all of a sudden. This has been going on for at least a decade now. Europe has come into its own. We've always been under-invested, under-capitalized, if you want to put it that way, compared to the US. I think we'd all acknowledge that the US has been overcapitalized for decades, but that's part of their model and they're okay with it. So I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying there's a gap between our approaches. On an absolute basis, Europe is putting 13 to 15 billion to work this year in the asset class in venture capital and growth capital. That compares to 4 or 5 billion just 10 years ago. So absolute numbers, it's a fantastic story. If you look at the gap, though, to the US, the US is well over 100 billion, right? Equivalent size economy, however you measure it, GDP, consumer basis, etc. So we're in a better place, but there's still some room to go.
And 10 years ago, they were around 30 billion and Europe was half of today's size at maybe 5 to 7 billion.
Correct.
And now we're talking 15 billion on European side and over 100 million in US side. So
over 100 billion.
Billion, yes. So it
and that ebbs and flows. You see, any given year, there's always a gap. It's usually 5-6 to 1 between Europe and the US.
Yes. And the money you collected this time, is it mostly European money?
Yeah. It's
because one of the tragedies of European funds had always been that, yes, European funding, European assets, but non-European capital.
About 70% of our capital is European.
70%. Good.
70% plus. Yeah.
And how much is sovereign funds? How much is family offices? How much is corporate VCs?
So rough report. Number one, we look for permanent capital. We look for capital that's deeply committed to the asset class, and we look for capital that is pursuing a mission. So a mission-focused capital. We believe in pension funds because their mission is returning investment income to pensioners who've worked hard all their lives. We love university endowments. We think they're fantastic. And foundations. We don't judge the mission. We just care that they have a mission, because that's kind of motivating to us as a team. What we're not interested in, just to explain it, is a very rich family just trying to be richer, or a corporation investing to return money to its balance sheet or boost its income statement. That's not interesting to us. So having said that, our investor base falls into these categories that I just mentioned. Very, very substantial families who've institutionalized their capital allocations and investment, but are also pursuing massive philanthropic interests, some kind of a mission that we find interesting. Number two, the pension funds. Number three, university endowments. And last but not least, other foundations. It could be in the medical area, can be in the educational area. We don't really care, but we like that kind of capital. And it allows us to filter out the kind of capital that we don't like quite as much.
Okay, understood. Good point. Now, you talked about growth, Europe, and tech. Europe is easily understood. Growth, you outlined. When you talk about technology, what kind of technology is it that you're most interested in with the new fund? There has been a huge B2C platform trend, as we know. But our feeling, my personal feeling, is that deep tech is advancing, is returning great returns, and is still in a pretty nascent stage in Europe. So how interested are you in hardware, in biotechnology, in artificial intelligence, in quantum computing? What are the main areas you'd be in spaceflight, in new space technology? What would be your focus for Fund 4?
Okay, so our strategy has changed very little from fund to fund. So if you go back to Fund 1 and look at what we pitched to investors, not much has changed. In fact, nothing has fundamentally changed. It's back to what I said at the beginning, focus, focus, focus. This may sound counterintuitive, but we are not the most thematic investor that you will meet. And the reason is we don't have to be. We're looking to invest in companies that have got real momentum, right? So I'm not trying to predict the future like an early stage fund. I don't have to predict the future. I'm looking for performance here and now, today. So therefore, I'm looking for companies that, you know, have maybe ridden the hype curve in a given area, AI or quantum or spaceflight. In our case, less exotic, more SaaS-style businesses in the enterprise area, marketplace models in consumer, some direct-to-consumer brands with specific consumer products like Huel, for example, or Zwift with their fitness platform. Gamified racing and fitness platform. All of them, you know, they went through a hype curve Some companies just go rock bottom. They crossed the chasm. They came back up the other side, and we're waiting on the other side. We're not trying to catch companies at the top of the AI hype curve. That's not interesting for us. That is for other investors whose risk profile and risk reward strategy is different than ours. So I just say that because it sounds counterintuitive. Everybody's thematic, you know. We're in fintech. We're in insurtech. We're in AI. I mean, if you're not in AI these days, everybody's in AI. Every company is trying to bring elements of AI, big data, into their model in some way, shape, or form. Everybody's leveraging the internet. But going back to your question on deep tech, we haven't done that much deep tech across funds 1, 2, 3. And I don't predict we will actually on fund 4. Now, having said that, we're very well set up to make deep tech investments if we want to. Some of our team members have been there in prior decades in their early careers and have tremendous track records in this area. I'm talking about more silicon-related and hardware-related investments. Our strategy tends to be more software-related on the enterprise side and more internet business model-related on the consumer side. And I'm not so sure I see that changing that much. There's just so much going on in both of these areas that we don't feel the need or compulsion to jump into other areas that, from our opinion, tend to have longer timeframes to realization for the companies. They tend to be less capital efficient as businesses. And sometimes if you go to biotech, which is not our specialty, so we would never invest in that space. It's not that we don't believe in it. It's just that we're not qualified. We have no expertise. So, and we never will. Back to focus.
Just to mention a few of your assets so your listeners know what we're talking about. You are invested in Get Your Guide, for example, in Outfittery, in Vault, in We, the former WeTransfer, and you have exited, to my knowledge, 9 companies, one of which is Finanzcheck.de, very much known to German consumers, Vistaprint, Wooga, Social Point. So this gives a flavor. How big is your team?
So we don't have a huge team. We're split between London and Geneva. We are 9 partners now, one of whom is our chief financial officer. So you could say 8 investing partners, investment-focused partners. We have a couple of principals on the team, just at level below partner. We have senior associates and associates. All told, our investment team is 14 people.
That's amazing.
So it's not a business where you need a lot of bodies, so to speak. We hire young people and we try to grow them in the organization, give them great progression and great experience with us. We don't have a churn and burn model, so we're not hiring loads of people and you know, burning them alive with whatever activity we focus them on. We like them to really spend time with us, grow with us, and develop their careers at Highland Europe. And we're starting to see the results of that with this first partner promotion of somebody who's come through the organization, and there will be more over the coming years, basically.
Fergal, the model itself, the fund model itself, has drawn some criticism almost always, but especially over the past years, what they call the 220 model has been criticized, especially as funds get bigger. So the traditional model, just for everybody on this show who is not that much familiar, the traditional model is 2% management fee on the assets under management and 20% carry on the profits that have been made with the deal, with all kinds of complicated structures that define waterfalls. But 220 is kind of the catchphrase. When you have like 1.8 billion under management, it's easy to calculate. In the traditional model, 2% of that is quite a huge amount of money for a 14-people team. So how have you adjusted, or how have you reacted to the criticism, not directed at you, your company, Highland Capital, but rather at the industry as such? Have you adapted to that?
Yeah, first of all, one thing that you and your listeners should be aware of is that the 2% doesn't last forever over the life of the fund. There's a declining scale, just to be clear. Basically, the 2% goes on the invested capital after the investment period is over. So if your invested capital is 70%, as an example, of the fund size and 30% is in reserve, the day you switch to a new fund, you're 70% of the 2%, so you're 1.4% from that period on. But the point still is valid. There's a lot of capital washing around in our industry, And I think some people choose to live off the fee in a way that's not great. I think the real money should be made on the carry, frankly. We are trying to reinvest as much of our fee as possible into our own funds, just to be very open with you. We pay well. We pay our young people well. And we pay ourselves market. No more, no less. And the difference, we tend to churn back into some platform-oriented development initiatives in the firm in terms of advisors, for example, in terms of marketing activities for our own firm, in terms of events. We do a lot of, we put a lot of investment into events to bring various people from across our portfolio together on a reasonably frequent basis. So CFO event every couple of years, a CTO event. And that way you create a peer network for your, for all the CTOs, all the CFOs, all the CMOs in your portfolio companies. So we have no hesitation kind of taking money out of our own pocket, because that's a choice. You can spend that on things like I just described, or you can put it in your own pocket. So that's what we do. The 2 and 20 model is at the low end of the scale, just to be clear.
They're really?
In the US, in particular, the top firms are more like 2.5 and 25 or 2.5 and 30, right? So if you go to any of the top five, or I won't mention any other firm here because I don't think that's appropriate, but if you were to pick a top 5 or 10 firm in the US, it's much closer to what I just described, with a fundamental difference in the waterfall. In the US, they have what's known as deal-by-deal carry. So you could get a return on your first investment out of a fund, and you haven't returned total capital yet, and you can still take carry.
You could have one hit, profit on the hit, and everything else just bombs, and your investors make losses on it, but you still have got, you still have pocketed.
But you're subject to clawback, meaning the investors can take that money back, but only on an after-tax basis.
Yes.
So it's really complex, this stuff, and it shouldn't, people shouldn't just draw the conclusion that, you know, there's different gradations of the system. In our case, we have what's known as the European waterfall. So we have to return all capital in the fund and a hurdle, which we've agreed with our investors. So they will make money before we touch a penny of profit share. And then we get our profit share. A little bit of catch up, and then it's 80-20 from then on. So that's totally fair. It's obviously fair because 700 million worth of capital just joined us and said, that's appropriate, that's fair. So, and you know, 463 million on the prior fund and 333 million on the prior fund and 246 on the first fund. So, you know, it's a simple market mechanism. It's a balance between investor demand and on the limited partner side and the general partner side. And we try to be balanced in our approach as opposed to going for the maximum that one could go for.
Understood. Now, you're Irish, if I understand correctly. Your team is half based in London, the other is based in Geneva. Why is it that you have your headquarters in Switzerland? What makes Switzerland in a good hub to do this? And secondly, technically, the fund is probably located in Luxembourg, right?
No, fund is Jersey.
Jersey.
Structure, yeah. The top of the manco of the management company is here. London has a subsidiary, so to speak. But essentially, we don't have a headquarters concept.
Why is it Geneva, not London, not Berlin, not Paris?
Yeah, because, first of all, we're a spin-off from Highland Capital Partners in the US, which is a fairly established 34, 35-year-old venture capital firm. I was a partner in Boston with Highland Capital Partners before creating Highland Europe. So we spun off. In a prior life, in a previous career with a company called Cambridge Technology Partners, I had built a big IT services business from here in Geneva. It started with the acquisition of a company when I was in a biz dev role at CTP, public IT services business based out of Boston. I bought a company here, had some issues, came here to fix the problems, ran the business, grew the business all over Europe. So I knew from that prior career that if your job involves a lot of travel, which ours does, we don't have a Silicon Valley here in Europe. So if you're going to do your job correctly, you're on planes and trains a lot. So logistics actually matters if you want to have any kind of a life. And I knew that going out of here in the morning is as the easiest thing you can imagine compared to any airport in Europe, because I had lived that experience for 5 years with that prior company. And the second thing I knew at the time when we launched here, and I'm going back to 2007 now, was that some European entrepreneurs are a bit upset about having to always go to London to talk to the money, so to speak. And it's not that they're upset, but it's like, why always go to London? You know, why don't you guys come to me? Or can't I go to Berlin or Paris or Geneva or Zurich for a meeting? So if you look at macro speaking, the UK and Ireland accounts for about 25% of the total venture capital and growth market in Europe, but 75% is on the continent. So I thought when we first launched, why not signal differently? Most US funds go straight to London because it's culturally comfortable, right? It's English speaking. It's where most US people go. All the US funds are straight to London. I said, no, I'm going to go back to Geneva. I'm going to launch the business from Geneva and I'm going to send a completely different signal to the entire market. And I can reach London, by the way, just as easily as I can Berlin or anywhere else. So that's how we started. And that's why we started from here.
That's a very good point. I think that the signal is being seen and being understood. And when you look at one of your, I don't know if you call them competitors, but Lakestar, for example, based out of Zurich and very strong presence in Berlin, Atomico, they have like tried to convey similar signals. Talking about Atomico and Lakestar, how important is it in your industry to differentiate yourself like in a brand awareness way of doing? Is it like in the consumer goods industry that you need a very, very sharp profile? And in Silicon Valley, obviously in the VC industry, you do need a very sharp profile. How is it in Europe? Do you need to profile yourself against somebody else?
Yes and no. We try not to profile against. I will never negative sell against another firm. Even if a founder asks me to, I'll say, no, that's your job to figure out. I'll tell you all about me. I'll tell you all about my firm. I'll tell you about our culture, our ethos. I'll share all of the CEOs we've ever backed. You can speak with them and you form your own opinion, but don't ask me to negative sell against Lakestar or anybody. I won't do it. Even if I have things I could negative sell on, I wouldn't ever. I think it's just a bad practice. The reality is our industry needs collaboration. I mean, we need to work together. We need to bring capital to these companies. The best founders need, they need help. They need genuine team orientation from the investor base, not cutthroat competition, right? And that's my way of saying that we try to bring an extremely founder-focused approach. And that is our primary differentiation. And when it comes down to it, I will tell a founder, you know, they ask you for your differentiation or your value add points and so forth. You know, yeah, we're brilliant with recruitment. Yes, we're fantastic with helping with the next fundraising round and the perfect intros. Yes, we've got great strategic perspective and all that. But I could talk about that. It means so little compared to you talking with 10, 20, 30, 40 of our CEOs and forming your own opinion. Just go call them. Here's all the numbers. Here's all the emails. And that goes full circle now, because if we are genuinely founder-led, founder-driven, and very positive in our orientation and collaborative in our orientation with founders, then the benefit comes, of course, when those calls come into them from other founders. You know, how do they work with you? Are they good? Are they competent? Are they collaborative? Are they positive? I'm 20 years in this business now, and I've seen a lot of bad behavior in boardrooms. And I just don't tolerate it anymore. I just say, time out. That's what happened. We just saw it. Now let's talk about what we're going to do going forward. Let's get behind the founders. Let's pick them up off the ground and show them, you know, they're beaten up. You don't need to beat them up anymore. Let's help them recover. So I just have a fundamental belief, and I think it's come across our firm and our entire culture, that a positive approach in the boardroom, outside of the boardroom, working with the founders, across the board, that'll deliver better results 9 times out of 10 than being a negative, you know, penny pincher with the sharp pencil and sharp elbows.
This definitely is true. And since our time is almost up, Ferl, I don't want to take too much of your time. Just two very short questions on a practical note, vis-a-vis investors and startups. People having listened to us now, if somebody wants to invest in your fund, it's probably not easy getting in, just as with Sequoia or, and other big firms. What would you advise them to do if they want to go with you, if they want to share with you? And second, same question for startups, for companies. You don't do early stage, as we understood, but for companies, if they want to be financed by you, how do they contact you? What's the best way to get in touch with you for both of these groups?
Yeah, well, first of all, they can email us. Any of the partners will respond. Any of the investment team members will respond immediately. We try to get back to everybody. Whether it's a suitable investment opportunity or not, we try to give something in terms of value add, in terms of feedback. If something's too early for us, we'll let the team know, and we'll ask them to keep in touch with us as their business develops. So that's in terms of founders. But they should really take time to get to know what we focus on. We get a lot of people emailing us about biotech and healthcare oriented investments when that's not our space. And if all they did was just look at the website and understood the strategy and our focus, they wouldn't bother sending the email in the first place. It's a waste of their time. And I would encourage teams and founders to be really, really efficient in their use of their own time and target the right investors. On the type of investors we're looking for, as I mentioned earlier, permanent capital, focus on growth stage and Europe, and pursuing some kind of a mission. We love that. And I described pension funds, family offices that are pursuing philanthropic interests, foundations, endowments, etc. That's what we're looking for. But spend the next 2 to 3 years to get to know us. So reach out to me. It's Fergal@highlandeurope.com. And you know, come and have a beer with us. Come and have a cup of coffee. Get to know us. Get our updates in the years ahead so that the next time we hit the fundraising button, your diligence is 90% done at that point. You already know us. You feel that you want to be invested with us, and it's only subject to kind of formal diligence at that point.
It's a very clear statement. So we understood you clearly and heard you loudly. Thank you.
Great.
And we taped this on the day before Christmas. So we will now let you go, Fergal, because you probably have to do some Christmas-related business now. Thanks for making the time and thanks for joining me.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you, Christoph.
Bye-bye. Das war der High Podcast. Dieser Podcast erscheint jeden Donnerstagabend um 18 Uhr. Damit Sie keine Folge verpassen, abonnieren Sie uns gerne jetzt. Oder hinterlassen Sie ein Like, wenn es Ihnen gefallen hat. Eine Produktion der Axel Springer High GmbH, einer führenden Beratung für Strategie und Umsetzung neuer Geschäftsmodelle. We support leaders in turning their organizations into 21st century winners. Über Post freuen wir uns unter christoph.kese@high.co.